This is Marketing Reads, a Chinese consumer connection where we look at books related to marketing in China. Our website is ccc.qbook.tv, where you can find other audio and video episodes with photos, links, and information related to today's conversation. Subscribe to leave comments and access research episodes with applied topics and research reports. The book I'm reviewing today is a book I wasn't really looking forward to. As usual, we've got these popular books written by journalists, and of course journalists seem to have the inside track for getting some book deals. They have to make a living, so you can't hold that against them. But as far as research goes, as far as insight goes, as far as really having a thick description that makes sense from the kind of perspective we're working on here at the Chinese Consumer Connection, they always fall short. So I didn't have much expectation when I came to the book I'm going to review today, which is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Factory Girls, you know, that really tells you what the book's going to be about. Anyone who knows anything about China is familiar with this story of migrant workers. You visit anywhere in the coastline of China, this is something you see. It's nothing really so new. It existed in Hong Kong previously. We've seen it before, but at the scale it's at now, it's quite different, quite impressive, quite chaotic, quite honestly. So this book, I really thought it would be a kind of another expose, just like the last book, The China Price, that would get in there and criticize a little bit, say that things are all screwed up. That's not what this book was, though. So let me quickly review some of the points of this book. The book's author is Leslie T. Chang, and the publisher is Spiegel and Grau. It's about a little bit less than 500 pages long. The general topic, of course, is this migrant movement. But it's not the direction you would think. It doesn't do hardly anything on the level of this kind of macro analysis in the sense of something like Thomas Friedman's crazy books that just look from this really high level and use these really pick a few silly examples to fit the context or fit the thesis. It's not like The China Price that comes in here and uses some specific stories to reinforce some nebulous macro judgment that something's fundamentally wrong and needs to be fixed. It doesn't do that at all. And in fact, I was sucked into the book right away, right from its first chapter. Let me give you the list of chapters first. Here are the names of the chapters. A little bit long, so hang in there, but it helps you get an idea of what the book's all about. Part 1, The City. Chapter 1, Going Out. 2, The City. 3, To Die Poor is a Sin. 4, The Talent Market. 5, Factory Girls. 6, The steel with no name. 7, square and round. 8, 8-minute date. 9, assembly line English. Part 2, the village. Chapter 10, the village. Chapter 11, the historian in my family. Chapter 12, the South China Mall. Chapter 13, love and money. Chapter 14, the tomb of the emperor. Chapter 15, Perfect Health. Now, if you look at those chapter titles, which is getting a bit long, right away I think you get this idea that titles like Going Out, The Talent Market, 8-Minute Date, these are not chapters that are having this faraway perspective, this macro perspective. These are chapters that are really picking specific topics and going home on them, really centering on them, really digging into them. Perfect health is a good example. Love and money is a good example. Assembly line English. Any foreigner who's been in Taiwan for any amount of time, that should ring a bell right away. Assembly line English. Okay, let me give you some of my impressions of this book, and I really want to recommend this book. When I got through the first few chapters, I was really getting into it. Ms. Chang just gets into this really deep, thick description at a very individual level, and that is really cool. It's rare to see a journalistic book that goes at it this way. It must be something to do with journalism school or writing courses where they're kind of wannabe novelist, adopt a certain voice, and that voice never really has that honesty. It's always kind of that 60 minutes, you know, I'm an expert and I'm going to tell you what's going on voice. Leslie instead goes right in there and in every line she's saying, who said what? I said this, she said that. She said this, her friend said that, I said this. I felt this, she said that. She reacted this way, I felt that way. That really brings it home of the person who's writing it. What's their involvement in the story? What's their level of the story? And that helps us as readers to judge what's the situation, what's the context, what's the meaning of these words that are being repeated in the book, rather than just saying, you know, this is some kind of objectified statement. This is something that somebody said, and I'm not going to tell you if it was relayed to me from somebody else or it was my own words or whatever, whatever. You know, that's the thing I can't stand. So if we look at it this way, the book is not far from an anthropological study. And in fact, when the first few chapters rolled by really fast, because I really got into it, I was really disappointed when all of a sudden we got pulled out of that and Ms. Chang went off on another thread. Now, she's been criticized. I see on Amazon a lot of people are critical of this structure she's given the book, and that it seems to have two main parts, and that is one part which is centered on the migrant workers in Dongguan area and what they're doing, and then another story which is the story of her family history. I mean, that's kind of obvious, and that does give you a bit of a jolt the way that's put in there. I think actually the book has three main parts. That's those two, the migrant workers and then Ms. Chang's family's history. But then I think there's another part that falls right in between those two, and that's Ms. Chang's slow, maybe not so slow, but I think it was slow because it was really a long time she was there. She was really embedded in that situation for quite a while. Her eventual coming around to seeing things from a very different perspective. And she doesn't lay it out that clearly in the book, but it's easy to read between the lines, and sometimes it leaks out. She came into this, I think, expecting to kind of have a more of a situation where she would see what is wrong with things and how things are going wrong, how these girls are being abused, and how the factory managers are being evil and bad. And what she ends up finding out is that actually the factory workers are, you know, just taking advantage of the situation just as much as the factory owners. And it doesn't seem like anyone's really to blame, but rather these are overall cultural situations that flow, ebb and flow in both directions, and there's really nobody to blame. And in fact, there doesn't seem to be that much quote unquote wrong or evil or bad going on. I'm sure she could have found a lot of bad things, and she's seen a lot of bad things, but even when she's talking about prostitution, she comes right out and says, you know what, I can't really blame anyone here. It's not like anyone is not a consenting adult. No one here is kidnapped and forced into anything. And hey, you know, this is the reality of what's going on, and there, that's it. And that is what's really good about the book. That is the best part of the book, that in between where we see how she comes around to that perspective. Now, of course, what I like most about the book are the details, the really deep details of understanding the local situation. And this is not a marketing book. This is not about marketing. But I really think that if you are a marketer, you're going to get a lot out of this if you're looking at China, because this is showing you what really a majority of the people in China, how they're living, thinking, working, what's going on with their lives. This is not going to be your people who are, you know, at the high end, educated end, you know, graduated from Tsinghua University or Beida. These guys are the vast minority. what we have in this book is just mainstream, in this case, young girls, teenagers, who are going to be the future consumers in this market. Now, I want to tell you more about this book, I think, in the best way I can, which is to go through some places that I've highlighted. But let me just begin at the very beginning of the book, because this really sets the scene. I think once you hear this, you can really believe me of what I'm saying. Chapter 1, the very beginning of this book, going out. When you met a girl from another factory, you quickly took her measure. What year are you? You asked each other, as if speaking not of human beings, but of the makes of cars. How much a month, including room and board? How much for overtime? When you might ask what province she was from, you never asked her name. Right there, I mean, right. She begins right at the detailed level. How, when people meet, what do they say? How do they speak? Now, the problem with this is that the book really does center on young people, very young girls, 16 to 21, in this kind of range. And this, of course, is the majority, your factory workers, migrant female workers. So it makes sense. What I'm a little bit surprised about and disappointed about is that Ms. Chang doesn't really have the anthropological training to take it further. She seems to report that this is a special case. And although she lived in Taiwan for a while, she's been in Hong Kong for a while, I think, she doesn't seem to draw the parallels, or maybe she never picked up on these things, because these things are so common. These behaviors are so normal, even in Taiwan, what we see for young girls, young women, I should say. And so I'm a little bit surprised that she's surprised. And that's a little bit of a disappointment in the book. It doesn't go further. It doesn't draw out a kind of theoretical structure. She's not an anthropologist, but, you know, so I guess I shouldn't expect that much. If she had written an anthropological book, maybe she could have, but it would have sold like 500 volumes instead of the sale she gets from this much better situation. Okay, let me go into the book and read a few sections that I really got interested in that draw my attention and see how you react to that, because I think this is really the meat of the book. In one part of the book, she's talking about how these girls move around and how they meet their friends and how they change their lives and how they're very changeable, I should say, how they're very easy to change things. She says that, Leslie Chang, that is, the author, says that later I moved to China, I often heard the same question that was one of the ways that Taiwan and China, which until recently had been technically at war, were more alike than they had imagined. So she does touch a little bit about this similarities, but then she doesn't really go into the detail of how behaviors and perceptions are so similar across the strait. And I was a little bit surprised at that. She seemed to be skipping over that. And in fact, when she talked about her family's history, she kind of skipped over Taiwan very, very quickly, although I think it was on purpose to give a picture, to give an image. So my suspicion is she has a lot of this idea, she has a lot of this understanding, but in this book she's just trying to center on her topic, which are the migrant female workers. Here's another little quote, see what you think of this. Either way, I understood the factory girls when they spoke of their complicated feelings for home. She can write this kind of thing because, of course, she is Chinese herself. She is an American Chinese. Her parents moved to America, and in fact, that's part of her story of her grandparents and parents. So this gives her a pretty good perspective. Of course, I would argue that there's a lot missing there, and she's not raising children in China. She's not living in the region. She's not going through all of the details. And so I don't think she's really seen it that up close until she went in to do this book, and then maybe she sees these things as being a little bit different or special. She has a really interesting idea in the book, and that is, let me read you this part. For all of them, that is the girls, modern history began with the handbag factory. And she really likes this idea that everything has just begun recently in the coastal southern China. before this, things were completely different. And now it's kind of like the Big Bang. Everything's happened all of a sudden. All this has just taken off. All this capitalism working in a factory. All of this begins with a handbag factory from Hong Kong. Okay, that's an interesting idea. Of course, the problem with that idea is that China itself is undergoing this big shift because it's undergone numerous shifts before of a political nature. But she does talk about that a little bit, so it's not like she doesn't know that. But it's an interesting parallel that I kind of picked up on. I think that was her trying to use that as a metaphor throughout the book. Everything's just begun recently. Since the late 80s, there's a big bang. Everything's changed since then. She has some very off-the-cuff kind of information I really like. For example, she's talking about the apartment she lived in, and she really tries to stay at the level that these girls are working at, too. Although she doesn't go in the factory, she doesn't live in a factory, she doesn't participate in a factory, she doesn't live in a dormitory. I mean, that would have been the next step. I think if she was doing an anthropological study, that she would have done that. But she doesn't quite do that. But she does mention, for example, the retail environment outside my apartment was in constant flux. I love that, because if there's anything you can see in China, it's that, you know, on the street, these shops are changing all of the time. You know, sometimes in a matter of weeks, usually within a matter of months, these shops are just constantly churning over. And that's a sign of, I think landlords charging too much rent to make easy money, but also a sign of there's no shortage of people willing to take risk to try to make a business succeed. Absolutely no shortage, and that comes across really well in this book with a number of stories she goes over. She also mentions, for example, that twice I bought city maps with bus schedules that both times the routes were already out of date. Things were happening too quickly to be written down. I love that. You know, I've had this problem before in China too. Bus routes or subways, you look at the map, and it doesn't apply because everything's changed already. Within a matter of months, these routes have all been changed. New subway routes have been constructed. This is the speed of change in China. Just amazing. She does hit on that. It's very interesting. So she does go through and make some very close friends in the book, and she covers up that. She also follows a couple girls through their different kinds of jobs. And the big message you get from this is that these girls can just completely change their lives, make themselves over, adopt new personalities. They get new mobile phones, a new phone number, and suddenly they can be a new person. You know, that's very interesting, very insightful. But that is not just a migrant factory worker thing. That is completely a Chinese thing. In Taiwan, we always see this. It's very common for people to change their name. I have extended family members who, within a matter of months, a number of sisters all change their name, and nobody knows what they're called anymore. And they will come visit the family, and they'll keep repeating their new names and correcting people or using their old names, because you can get a new Chinese name at any time. And this is thought to be highly influenced by, you know, you want to get the right feng shui to get the right name, because if you have the wrong name, this can influence your health. And I've had a number of people I know, people I've worked with, research assistants, who just come in one day and their name has changed. And the reason was they weren't feeling well, they went and got their feng shui checked out, and the name was giving them bad fortune, so they had to change that. And they just completely change that, and they adopt what they think is a new persona they put on, and that's it. And you often can see this also with the way people study a foreign language. So they're studying English, and they'll just come in and just take a name and all of a sudden make up their persona. You meet them a year later, they've taken a different English name and has a different persona. When I first moved to Taiwan, there was a guy I was teaching. He was maybe in his mid-20s, early 30s, and a little short guy, and his name was Rambo. It cracked me up to no end, right? Every time I had to say the name, I had to stop myself from laughing. But that's the persona he wanted to project. And so I think there's something about that that's universal in Chinese culture, where in the West, especially in America and Western Europe, there's a big emphasis on you express yourself from the inside out. But in a Chinese cultural situation, it's much more about this idea from the outside in. So if I can create an outside persona, it can project inward and recreate me. So I don't think this is just a factory girl thing. I also think the book is thrown off a little bit. Leslie Cheung talks so much about this, and she's kind of in amazement about how these girls can just, you know, completely change, leave their friends. Again, I think this is just really basic mainstream Chinese culture, and these girls are young. So, I mean, you've got young girls, 16, 17, 18. They're very, you know, impulsive, basically, like all teenagers. So that's, I really didn't come away with that as much as she does. It's a great way to see that, but she never really plays up on its kind of fundamental structural issues. Rather, she says these are the factory girls. So I'd warn the reader that the things you're reading here are not so much unusual as much as mainstream. Let me just quickly jump through a few more quotes I wrote here. I don't have the page numbers because I got the e-book. I'm in the e-books. I don't want to get any more dead tree books. They're too much trouble. So let me scan through my e-reader here and see what else I can find. She had a really interesting quote when she was, I think she was observing a situation at a cram school. And this cram school was pretty interesting. It was a place where they were offering lessons to, like public speaking kind of lessons, job interview lessons, tutoring you how to do a great job interview. And it was a whole person kind of reforming, motivation, self-improvement kind of thing. And this, of course, is huge in Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan. Of course, you know, self-improvement is a big thing in America, too. It's the main seller at bookstores, I suppose. But it really goes over well here. And she was attending one of these classes where they were getting people together to, you know, really be confident and to speak up and to say who you are and etc. And I think they were trying to get someone to, if I remember right, they were trying to get someone to stand up and begin and give a demonstration, and nobody wanted to, and then finally somebody did, or the whole group got together to encourage the person. And they kind of ganged up on this person all of a sudden. They were all going in the same direction, even though they don't know each other, and even though these girls, from what Leslie was observing, don't really like to make close friends. They can be living in a dormitory room with, you know, 4 to 10 people in a single room, and they don't really make friends there, but they make friends outside. And to the Westerner, this seems weird. Why wouldn't you have a friend that's in your room or a friend that's down the hall? And why is that? Why can you be so close and yet still be strangers? And then all of a sudden, sometimes everyone will be acting in unison and ganging up and trying to get something done or pushing someone to do something. And her quote goes like this, and I thought it was really good. Whenever I watch Chinese people interact in a group setting, I understood in my bones how the Cultural Revolution happened. People were terrified of being singled out, but for the safety of the group, they could turn on someone with a speed and ferocity that took your breath away. I've often said this myself. This is an observation I've made. When I first moved to Taiwan in 1989, I was kind of a conservative, Republican-leaning, thinking, you know, these communists, a very anti-communist kind of opinion. Especially on the Hong Kong kind of thing, you know, how can the UK just turn Hong Kong over? Why isn't this put up for a vote, etc., all these kinds of things. But after I lived in Taiwan a few years, I realized, you know, all of these books I had read about the Cultural Revolution and these the torture of people and the confessions and the dunce caps and the re-education and all of these things. They are not actually such strange behaviors. They are not drawn out of the air and made up by the communists just for the Cultural Revolution. They were actually based on what I see every day at school, even little kids doing, how they work in groups and how they gang up on certain people and how they, even though they're not making friends as a clique, but they move together in a group when they have to or when they're encouraged to or when they're afraid of something. And so these behaviors are just completely normal and embedded in the culture. And she's picked up on that and reports it here. And I think that was really insightful and something that took some courage to say, because, you know, this is really not politically correct stuff to say. But it's so clear if you're really familiar and living within the culture. Okay, so I think that's enough of these specific examples. I don't want to bore you to death, but I find that to me, these were really exciting and interesting. I just couldn't put the book down. When Ms. Chang goes off onto her personal family history, basically she's looking back at her family and their struggles through the end of the war period, the Japanese war, and then the communist, and then her family moves to Taiwan. And I don't want to really push on that too much. It turned me off a little bit because she didn't really fill it out well. And it seems like it's people like her family that have really caused immense difficulties in the Taiwan-China situation. That is, the Chinese, that KMT, that came to Taiwan basically through force and bloodshed, took over the island, and then kept the island from becoming a nation, from being in the UN, and all because of the decisions of Chiang Kai-shek. The island now suffers from a situation that is not of the people's doing. And even though it's a democracy, they don't have any of the rights of a democratic country. A really weird situation caused by people from the KMT that came over. And they had a really bad attitude. And she mentions that. She just mentions in a line, well, you know, my father lived in Taiwan these years, I think it was over 10 years, never learned the local language and left and didn't have much to say about it. It kind of reminds me of Ronald Reagan's autobiography when he mentions his first wife. You know, in his huge book he has, she occupies one line. He says, they were married, didn't work out, they're divorced. So I really want to hear a little bit more about that so I can understand the situation. So I really like to hear more about that. But anyway, also, I think her family history is used as a narrative structure to the book. And while I find her family history to be interesting, and I really find more interesting is how she finds her own viewpoints or kind of comes around to a different viewpoint from what she started out with. That I really like, but I think that the book suffers from being forced into a kind of narrative structure. And I think this is typical of a lot of writers today, these kind of journalistic writers that take a story, say like the Enron story, and then they create a kind of narrative structure to it, and somehow it all flows together like a movie. It all makes sense in a kind of linear and temporal way. And I think that's kind of funny because in the meantime, you know, on the nonfiction side, everybody's trying to force their books into these kind of narrative structures like stories. And on the fiction side, instead of having authors move towards these narrative structures, actually authors are moving away from that. And of course, I read things like Pynchon, and he's, you know, completely away from any kind of temporal or narrative structure and just, you know, shooting these ideas directly into your brain. I really wish we could have just had more of the thick description without trying to force it into a structure. But I think she does pretty well. She doesn't give it any kind of false meaning. It's just her story gets imposed on us. Her family story gets imposed on it. I think that could have actually been another book that would have been interesting and could be fleshed out more in detail. Okay, so that's really gone way too far. I've really said too much, haven't I? If you haven't fallen asleep or turned this podcast off already, then wow. Maybe you should go get this book because it really excited me. Research-wise, what's this going to do for your research? Okay, this is not going to help you on the research at all. It's not going to give you any kind of insights onto methodology. This is the weakness of the book. However, on the observation side, you know, if you could actually make any observations, learn anything from Leslie Chang's work, then you would really improve your research ability. Too many researchers, especially in the culture area, are way too detached, not embedded enough, not thick description enough, not involved enough. I mean, I love it when I read about Miss Chang and she's taking a train out to the countryside to go see one of her subjects' homes, and they talk about being stuck on the train and peeing out the window, and you know, everybody's using the same water to wash their private parts with. Really, that's in the book. This is great. This just makes me feel that I can trust what she says because she's really there. That is way better than if somebody says, one of my subjects told me, one of my participants told me that they share water out in the countryside. Can you believe that? The government should definitely do something about that, you know? Ms. Chang doesn't make any judgment about that. And she's talking about, I did it, I was there, and I watched what they said, and I followed what they did, and this is what they did, and this is how they felt, and this is how I reacted, and I went along with this, and I totally respect her for that. A researcher could learn a lot from that kind of approach. On the business side, you're going to learn about how these young people who are growing up in China are developing their attitudes and how they're seeing things. And I think the one lesson that comes off is something that anyone who's been doing business in China kind of knows already, and that is that Chinese consumers can switch on a dime. They are not going to be super loyal. They're not going to stick with one thing. They're easy to change. They're easy to move over to a completely different approach, a completely different brand or topic. They just switch on a dime. It's very easy for them. However, at the same time, you know, once they get into something, they get into it really deep. They can get into all the different parts of it. They're not shallow at all. And I think there was a big part in her book about this, about this self-improvement and some food and diet stuff. They can really get into it, and that's true in Taiwan, where we see things like Quaker Oats have just really, you can't go anywhere without seeing this stuff just fly off the shelves because Quaker has told a story, has kind of given a perspective of this healthy food, good for your heart. And of course, in a place where a lot of people have high blood pressure from eating too much salt and too much fat in the oil for their cooking, wow, this stuff just grabs people and they just love it. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned there, and I think you can pick up a lot on what the future of the market's going to look like. You know, there's a lot of talk about mobile phones and how they just run through mobile phones, change mobile phones left and right, changing numbers all of the time. Some really interesting information that might surprise people who are not actually there and show how complicated and complex these consumers are. And they're not going to be easy to get a handle on. Okay, so I guess if you haven't caught already, I'll repeat myself. Highly recommended. I'm looking forward to reading a future book by Leslie Chang, and I really hope she can focus on a topic without giving any of that kind of artificial structure narrative approach. I would love that. This is Marketing Reads, a Chinese consumer connection where we look at books related to marketing in China. Our website is ccc.qbook.tv, where you can find other audio and video episodes with photos, links, and information related to today's conversation. Subscribe to leave comments and access research episodes with applied topics and research reports.